Anything combat with Johnny K.
But it's anything combat, though.
Welcome back. That's the Anything Combat show. I'm Johnny K. Today, we've got an announcer on the show for Golden Boy Boxing, WEC, and the UFC. Please welcome to the show, Joe Martinez. Welcome to the show.
Johnny K. What's up, man? How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on the show today. When I was researching you, Joe, I found out that you graduated California State University with a communications degree. So how do you think the communications degree helped your announcing?
It absolutely did not help me at all. I honestly am not even kidding. It was like I was thinking, okay, this is going to be the avenue to get on. For us in America, it's ESPN is the goal, or it's Fox Sports. And thinking, you know, I wanted to be a sports anchor, and I thought, okay, I got to get a degree from somewhere to do this. But honestly, every time I thought I was doing the right thing, it was like I was being pulled in another direction. And that's kind of how I ended up ring announcing and public address announcing, which is, you know, basically hosting events, live events, and not necessarily talking about them, if that makes sense to you.
I saw an event the other night on YouTube with you, and it was Luke Rockhold Bisping 1. Now, I'm in Australia, so I believe you did the Aussie, Aussie, Aussie during that event. So that was an electric crowd. Personally, for me, I think you should do more crowds. I don't know what the UFC's doing, but I think they've got you in that apex, that small room. I think your personality, I think they should get you in bigger crowds for the UFC, don't you reckon?
Hey, you know, I mean, I appreciate every opportunity, every rep I get, you know, with under the UFC banner is a blessing to me, you know. And of course, I'd love to do more arena shows. And they do let me out of the apex here and there. But it's also, you know, it's not exactly my gig, I would say. You know, it's Bruce has been the UFC for, you know, since UFC, I believe 13, and we're over we're approaching 308 now. So, to come in and make that sort of demand, no, I wouldn't do such a thing. But like I said, they do give me some bones here and there, and it's, those are just great opportunities. Those are the type of things that really keep you going and also keep me humble into respecting this sport for what it is. And it's, you know, I think in an apex atmosphere, you get to, you're so up close and personal with the event that you can really appreciate what goes into the performance. And I think the fans, it's such a unique experience for them. You're hearing every shot. You're hearing every coach, you know, give direction. And I think it just gives you another level of appreciation as opposed to sitting, you know, mid-level at an arena and just watching the event. You know, it's quite unique. It's super fun. But at times, it's kind of, I've sometimes compared it to maybe announcing, oh gosh, I don't want to say this. I don't want to get myself in trouble. But, you know, sometimes it's really quiet in there. And it kind of, as an announcer, I think we play a lot on crowd energy. And when it doesn't seem to exist, it's a bit concerning, self-concerning, I would say. So I think that's where the humility comes into play. Staying humble, you know, announcing the apex, it will humble you. It will humble you. And it just reminds you that, look, this isn't about the announcer. This is about those two men or women inside the octagon that are performing. So that's where I like to lead it. I don't take credit for what I do. I'm a glorified name caller, and I'm blessed to be in the position I am.
The apex, as we know, is small, and you're talking about that crowd energy. You've been doing this for a very long time throughout the early 2000s and all the baseball stuff as well. So you've been doing this for forever now. Do you feel like announcing for smaller promotions in a smaller crowd is harder if the event is like a rowdier crowd, you know, those rowdy crowds that are a little bit edgy, do you feel like that's harder for you, or do you just not care?
No, I love rowdy crowds. I love participation. It's the ones that are quiet that I'm terrified in. You know, it's a big event, a small event. If it's quiet, I'm terrified. Take it
I'm
personal.
meaning more like if they're booing you, Joe.
Oh God. Let's hope I don't ever get to experience such a thing. You know, and you know, I've heard boos, but it wasn't because I did something wrong. It was because they didn't like a decision that was read. So I've been a part of that. I've been a part of chairs flying into rings and bottles and beers and you name it coming at you. So it's, you know, it's duck and cover or get out of the way, one of the two, or you're gonna wear something.
What was the event that the chairs came in?
I was in Puerto Rico at a boxing event, and it was two natives of Puerto Rico that were fighting each other from different towns. And the hometown kid didn't get the decision. And I mean, a brawl broke out right in front of me. And I was actually watching the fight. And this guy's cheering for the other guy, and vice versa. And he didn't like what he said. So he gets up, he had a cast on, and he just cracks the guy. And it was just like dominoes, but they kept colliding and colliding. And next thing you know, it's just all the way up into the stands. And it's funny because the police station was right across the street from the venue. And the cops were in there, and they had their clubs. And there was this one little cop guy, and I saw him. And I'm looking at him, and there's a guy up in the stands, and he's a pretty big fella. And he makes eye contact, and that guy just beelined for the cop. And I'm like, oh my gosh! And you see the cop, and he's just like, just backing up, like, no, I'm out. I'm not doing this. But you know, eventually they funneled them all out of the back door, and the local kid ended up losing the fight. Chairs are flying all over the place. You know, gallon jugs of Gatorade are flying into the ring, and it was pretty wild. This is probably, oh, a good 12 years ago or so, at an event. It was pretty funny. Now looking back on it, but initially I'm like, oh crud, where am I gonna go? You know, I don't got anywhere to really get out of the way here. It was a municipal auditorium, which is was converted, you know, into a fight arena for that evening.
How many countries you've been to?
To put a number on it, I couldn't, honestly. I would say we're somewhere around 30 at this point. I spent a good chunk of time with Cage Warriors for a good 5 years, I'd say. All over the Middle East, of course, all over the UK, and some European shows as well. With UFC, as you mentioned, Queensland. I've been over to New Zealand a couple times, Singapore, headed for China in November to Macau. But yeah, I love those opportunities to go outside and experience different cultures. The Australian fans were phenomenal, and I remember the event you're talking about. And that was that Aussie was just it was a whimsical moment. Because as you know, my phrase is the judges are ready, the fighters are ready. And I like to pick the city I'm in to kind of inspire them to get loud. And I know you're a battle cry over there. So I used that as my segue into everything, and it just popped. It was pretty cool.
Dude, Australian crowds, I don't know why the UFC doesn't come here more often. They've just signed that deal with Sydney to with the government to come here more often, because every time an artist, like a musician, comes here, all the Australians know the songs. Every time there's a soccer match from the EPL in Britain, or they bring the La Liga from Spain, the Australians know it. Every time fights come down to Australia, it's just madness. We had the biggest crowd UFC history, which was Whittaker Adesanya won. Australia is just we're a hectic crowd. We get rowdy, we get involved, we love getting involved because it's rare for us. We don't get a lot of events, so when it comes, we really cherish it. So, do you want to come back to Australia?
Yes, send the ticket. I'm on the way. Let's go. And if I made those decisions, it would be monthly. But it's I'm of course not my decision to make. But yeah, I'm happy to hear that, you know, we're gonna be spending some time over there. If it's me, yay, I'm on board. Like I said, I'll go wherever they ask me to go. I'm happy for the opportunity wherever it is. But yeah, I mean, if for those out there who haven't been to an event in Australia, make it one for sure, because that's a bucket list item for a fight for sure.
You spoke about the decisions. In recent memory, there was a really bad decision with, I would say personally for me, Chito Vera, Corey Sandhagen, when Chito got the split decision, the scorecard. He didn't win the fight, but he got the scorecard. So everyone was like, what the fuck is going on here? In your opinion, what was the worst decision that you saw?
Manny Pacquiao and Timothy Bradley. Fight one.
Yep.
That was a fight that I watched and I was like, no way. I could not believe it. Could not believe it. There have been a number, I'm sure, but that's one that, you know, asking that question off the top of my head, that pops out to me. You know, and I'm a big advocate, and I speak it freely, that I believe judges should be held accountable, and it should be actively accountable. Not saying we need to have open scoring, but it wouldn't hurt. It's one of two sports, boxing and MMA, that do not have a live scoring system. You know the score of tennis, you know baseball, football, and I'm sure this has been spoken several times by other people greater than I, but I have the same sentiment towards scoring, and I think it should be known who's winning a fight. And I think one of those against it may be saying, well, if this guy knows he's up a few rounds, why don't he, maybe he'll take a couple rounds off, or, you know, and if he does, then hey, then the other guy can win some rounds and maybe, you know, gain some steam and put him, you know, on notice, you know, something like that's going to, it could change a fight.
I think personally for the open scoring, even if they were to, put it down, and as you said, the fighter that's two or three rounds up in a five-round fight, they're coasting through, and the other fighter, I don't think if you're a championship-level fighter, you already have the fight IQ either to coast or not to coast. It's not going to change, let's say, Khamzat Chimaev. If Khamzat Chimaev sees that he's two rounds up, he's not going to coast. He's going to go ballistic like he has in every other fight. So a fighter that goes ballistic and that's his style, it's not going to change it. I think it's just going to be, fighters are just going to have more information to do what they were already planning to do.
I agree with that. And I think it wouldn't be as I'm going to take a round off so much in MMA as it would be in boxing with a 12 rounder. You know, if you're up 6-0, you're a round away from winning a decision. So maybe that's, you know, a little bit something a little bit that, you know, would make more of a difference. I do like live scoring though. And I know there've been some experiments with it. I know Invicta's done it over in Kansas City. And it's pretty cool. I enjoy it. I like everybody to be able to know. There's no surprise there. It does take away that element. But we'll see. It's a young sport. Mixed martial arts is a very young sport.
1993, the UFC came in. Hasn't been around for a while.
Still young. Yeah, still very young. Comparatively, you know, when you look around the world of sports, baseball's been around since the 1800s, and football, you know, shortly after that, and on and on. And basketball, of course. There's a scoring system for everything, and you know, obvious points, of course. You can't hide a run being scored or a basket being scored or a touchdown. But how is a judge seeing a fight? I'd really like to know that.
With you being a fan of the combat sports, where did you find your love for the combat sports first? Was it boxing or was it MMA?
It was boxing. I remember watching UFC in 93, you know, back in those days with Hoist and Chemo, you know, the different characters that came out into the sport. And I was kind of, I wouldn't say I was a fan of it yet, because it was so, and it's still a niche sport, but it is more worldwide, of course, but it does have a niche fan base. So I would say boxing primarily was my ticket into combat sports, and it was my first passion. I was a Sweet Science fan, and growing up with who I did, I mean, I had Mike Tyson and I had Sugar Ray Leonard and Duran and just name after name of high performing, pugilists in the square ring. And then of course the octagon is birthed. And now you're like, okay, this is different. It's neat. And when it became sanctioned and we had weight classes and rules, now it's something to pay attention to because it's being taken as a real sport, no longer as some would describe as human cockfighting or worse, but a real sport. And of course, UFC, where it is today, I mean, it's undeniably a sport. There's so much behind it that goes into it, and nobody out there fighting in the world that's becoming a mixed martial artist that's growing themselves into that realm is saying, they want to be world champion. When they say they want to be world champion, the organization they're talking about is UFC, right? I mean, there are a couple out there, that do exist, and I've worked with several of them, and they have their world champion belts. But the true world champion you've got to know is in the UFC.
Most definitely. And also with the UFC fans and you saying that it's a niche sport, it is. And what I found so funny about this niche community is that they're so, how can I say it? Like equality, everyone talks about it. But the American fan base, to bring in these new cultures that are fighting and to be such fans of the sports that random fighters on the card. I saw a meme. It was an American fan and it was showing him back in 2006. And it's like Tank Abbott versus some other guy. And it's like there's two Americans fighting. And then it goes 2024. And it's an American. And he says, oh, Rinat Fakhretdinov and versus Nursultan Ruziboyev. What a great fight, right? And that, if that doesn't explain to you what's happened with the sport, I don't know what does. And it also shows that the fans, these guys are coming from Uzbekistan, these Ingushetia, Dagestan, Chechnya, these random places, and they love the sport so much that they learn where the fighter's from and they respect the other person coming in. And I think that's great. That's a perfect example of what MMA's done. It's actually brought everyone together.
Yes, I agree 100%. 100%. And I think when we began in its infancy with Hoist was really the birth of jiu-jitsu in America and worldwide. It was like, what is this he's doing? Like this little guy, there's no way. And here he goes, throw somebody in an arm bar or rear naked choke or whatever this he decided to do. With who to whoever he chose to do it to. Okay, let's learn this. And now you've got, of course, combat sambo and so many different forms that have become recognized that it is truly mixed martial arts. It's not just karate or taekwondo or judo. It's everything. And you've got to be a well-rounded artist in this game to be successful. You can't just be a good
Most
stand-up
definitely.
fighter. You can get exposed, of course, on the ground as a good boxer from somebody who has a ground game. All he's got to do is get inside on you and get you on the ground, and well, there you go. Which is why, if you saw Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather, there's no way Floyd gets in an octagon with Conor, or anybody, even a lower ranked fighter. At featherweight, or let's just even go to bantamweight at 135, or even let's go to flyweight. There's no way. You take anybody on the UFC roster and put them in an octagon with Floyd Mayweather, I would say 9 out of 10 times, if not more, 9.9 out of 10, is going to beat Floyd in MMA.
What about if it's Terence Crawford versus Conor
In an octagon?
Did you hear what he said? But Crawford, he started wrestling. No, he started wrestling. He was wrestling before boxing, and he sent out a couple videos online of him wrestling. And he's like, "I'm in the wrestling room, like Conor McGregor. You better wait for me. I'm coming."
Money talks, bro. Nowadays, nothing surprises me. Nothing surprises me anymore. I mean, you got YouTubers making millions of dollars putting on fights that two guys that are hanging around behind a keyboard are saying, "I'll fight you," and they end up fighting each other. And people pay to see it. They show up. So nothing is out of the ordinary anymore, I will say.
Let me see if something does surprise you. Maywood Activity Center, California. Was this a weird thing to announce?
How? Where'd you even get that?
I do my research.
You sure do. Yeah, I mean that's you're talking East LA. That was my first boxing match ever. Heck, I didn't even have a tuxedo. I went to a rental shop and told the promoter, I said, "I don't have a tux." He says, "Well, go rent one and I'll just pay for it." I made $450, including my tuxedo rental, to do that fight that night. Which was great. And you know what? It's part of growing. It's honestly, it's part of growing. You want to do something in life, you've got to start somewhere. And it honestly, it doesn't really matter where it is. It's getting reps. And it was a low level fight, and not that I expected to be on HBO at that point. Being as young as I was and still green, didn't really even know how to call decisions out. But learning. So you've got to build that foundation somewhere, and I was grateful for that opportunity. And the story behind that, of course, is I'm announcing college basketball, and the guy running the scoreboard recommended I get into boxing. And the next thing I know, the promoter calls me and tells me my uncle recommended me to do his fight. And I said, "Sure, I'll be there." And the man and I are not related in any way. He vouched for me, and the rest is history. It was pretty awesome. Dean Lohies in California. He went to bat for
How
me.
long did it take? How long did it take you to really get your groove in the industry? Like, did you have a period where you were making a lot of mistakes, and then it kind of you figured it out?
No, I never made mistakes. I was very thorough in my preparation. I'm not saying I never made a mistake. I've made mistakes. There have been instances where I was given an incorrect decision, and I had to read those. And of course, it looked like I was the one that made a mistake. Antonio Banuelos, this is years ago with WEC in New Mexico, Rio Rancho. And I can't remember who he fought that night, but I was given a draw, and he won a majority, I believe. So I had to go back in and correct it. WEC was under the Zuffa banner at the time, and I got a phone call on Monday, and it was, "Hey, what happened?" Because the commission's saying you screwed up. And I said, "Here's exactly what happened." And I watched him write the incorrect scores down. He gave them to me. I told him they were incorrect. He says, "Nope, those are right." I go up and I read what he gave me, and I go back down and I hand it to him. I said, "These are wrong." And he looks at it again and he goes, "Okay, they're wrong." And he corrected it. So I get on the thing and I say, "I have to go back in and announce the correct winner." And I go up and do it, of course. Yeah, but he threw me under the bus when it wasn't my bus to be under. So but those things happen, and I know you probably saw the female fight just a few months ago when, the announcer over there in Australia had a bit of a mess in his winner announcement. And he actually announced the wrong winner that won the world championship and had to go and recorrect, that one. And it's tough, man. But that also comes with reps. You have to have a lot of reps, and you can't get complacent in this game. There was a point in my career where I'm doing fights every single weekend, and sometimes you can get a little complacent. And there was an instance where, I read a wrong winner, and he was actually not even the fighter in the ring. He was the next fight. So the ref
Which one was
looked at
it,
me.
Quinjo?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. This is years ago, but the ref turns around and he goes, "Who won?" And I looked and I said, oh, I said, "Excuse me." And I had to get it correct. And then the original kid's name that I had said he fought next. And I introduced him and he actually won the fight. And I said, "Hey, you won twice tonight." You know, because I got to say his name twice as the winner. But that was a lesson for me in complacency as well. But yeah, those are rare moments that do happen and you try to keep them at a minimum. And I think that, I've gained respect for getting things correctly and being efficient in getting those things done in a timely manner.
They are rare. One of them was the Herb Dean Classic with the no contest, no decision. What do you remember from that?
So that's a Nevada thing. And in Nevada, it's called a no decision. UFC wants it called a no contest. So I ask Herb, what is it? He says it's a no contest. So I go down to the commission, says it's a no decision. And I call the truck and the truck says it's a no contest. And they say, what did the commission say? I said a no decision. They go, no, say no contest. So I say no contest. Then the commission gets mad at me and says it's a no decision. Get it correct. So then the next fight, it had to happen again. And I had to say no decision. Then the truck calls me. UFC says it's a no contest. And I'm like, oh my gosh, dude. So I got Mark Ratner. Thank God. He used to work for the Nevada. He was the executive director for Nevada State Athletic Commission. And I said, Mark, please, I need you to intervene here. And let's come to an agreeable term. If UFC wants no contest, please get the commission on board. And vice versa. If whatever we have to do, because I'm so tired of dealing with this thing that nobody can agree on what the same thing is called. You know, a no decision is a no contest and the other way around as well. It's just, it comes down to nuts and bolts and apples and oranges, basically. It's the same thing. Well, apples aren't oranges, but apples and apples, let's just say. So I think we're okay now. And I hope you're not referring to the Bilal eye poke where people are saying Herb Dean gets pissed at Joe Martinez, because that wasn't Herb Dean being pissed at me. It was Herb doing his job. The truck in my ear trying to get a result and me interrupting Herb while he's doing his job. And the way that came across was that Herb was pissed at me. Herb and I have a great relationship, you know? And I don't know how many times I've been asked about that, but of course you would bring it up. So thank you. And to all those out there that believe Herb is pissed off at me or was, there's more context to everything than sometimes you get to see. So, yeah, trust me, Herb and I have a very good relationship.
Joe, how do you structure your card? I watched a video with Bruce Buffer and he was showing all of his highlighting and the different color coordinating that he does with his card so he can have his notes. What do you do to structure your announcing?
I use a blue pen and a red pen. And that's it. Blue corner.
Ugly.
Yep. Style, height, weight, record, where he's fighting out of, and his name. If he has a nickname, I add the nickname. I have a space above his name for his nickname and a space below for phonetics because I like to get everything correct when I'm saying things. Same thing on the red side. Style, height, weight, record, where he's fighting out of, and his name. Judges and everything is in blue. Everything is in blue except for the red corner.
And when did you start doing that? You started that from the very start?
Colors. I started adding colors probably about, maybe 20 years ago.
With the card, do you find it easier to just color coordinate it or does it really not matter to you? Because Bruce is very meticulous about it. That's why I'm asking you.
My designations are colors. That's all I need, really. I don't have a whole lot of notes. Bruce has to say, you know, a lot of times different sponsors and whatnot. I do for boxing because I do a lot of large events in boxing. But I keep it in blue, and if it's a sponsor, I put it in red. But yeah, it's pretty straightforward for me. I don't I don't require a lot. I'm pretty easy going with all that stuff. I just like to have my things in order because I know how my flow, what my flow chart looks like, just as Bruce does. So I think each announcer has his own specificities that matter to help them be successful in what they're trying to do.
Joe, there was an event, I believe it was UFC Vegas 91, and during the telecast, you got replaced by Charlie Arnold during this one. So can you tell me what exactly happened backstage? What was the story behind this?
Yeah, I actually had pneumonia, and I was backstage before the co-main event, and I was throwing up. And as I'm disgorging, my sound tech was over next to me, and I told him, I said, let me know when they're done so I can go back in. And I'm like mid vomit, and he goes, oh shoot, it's over. I'm like, okay. And I run out there, and I had no voice, and I jump up there, and like nothing was coming out, you know. And they knew. I informed my producer on Monday. I said, hey, I've got pneumonia. It's really bad. I have no voice. You know, can we get Bruce to switch with me for next week? And it just wasn't possible. So I said, I'll be there. And I honeyed and hot teed my way the whole week. I got a steroid shot and whatever antibiotics I could to try and get myself ready. And, I was probably going into that fight vocally around 30%. I wasn't there. My head was just spinning the whole night. And I was so disappointed, humiliated. You know, I felt awful. I felt like I let the organization down. I feel like I let the fighters down, the fans. Not that I take a lot of stock in pleasing fans or anything, but for me it was a humbling moment as well. But it was also a neat opportunity for, you know, Charlie to come in and do something. And now we joke about it. I'm saying, you know, I said, Charlie, you know, you go and you get me sick so you can make your debut and take all this glory, you know, good for you. But, you know, in the meantime, I'm in the back, you know, just losing everything that was in me, and nobody cared. It was like Charlie makes UFC debut, first female in the octagon, and I'm like, Joe Martinez is dead in the back and nobody cares. You know, that's how I felt.
Was that the most you had to push for a show?
That's the most. That was the most. And let it also be known, because I don't know if many do, you know, I did come back for the main event and get that done. So, you know, I wasn't on full quit. They left it up to me. Do you want to continue? And I said, I just don't have it. I said, let me see what I can do. And they loaded me up with some more honey and some more tea. And I said, let's just do this main event. Let's see if we can make it happen. And yeah, we got through it. But I mean, I'm honest. My wife is next to me, and I was in literal tears. I was a bit embarrassed, honestly.
Joe, wouldn't it have been good in the article that if they wrote that you went back to the main event? Because out of all the articles I read, that wasn't mentioned.
Yeah, maybe I could have saved a little bit of face there. Yeah, but whatever. It is what it is. It's over with. Nobody ever talks about it except for Johnny K, so it's not even a big deal anymore.
With combat sports, can you tell me who's your favorite combat sport athlete of all time?
Someone I love to watch fight. I love to watch Cheeto fight. I love to watch O'Malley fight. Connor's so entertaining. You know, I knew Connor, of course, back in Cage Warriors days. Just a thrill to watch. I love Patty. I mean, I've known Patty since he was a kid. You know, there's so many out there. To pick one is a bit unfair. For me, you know, coming up in the sport, I always loved to say Uriah Faber's name. I felt like it was one of the best punches I had. But yeah, I mean, there's so much talent that has come since then. Chad Mendez, I mean, he came out of the Team Alpha Male family. And, I've made friends with a lot of them. And Cub Swanson, you know, Lance Palmer's one of my guys that I've always enjoyed seeing. More recently, Timba Garimbo, he's become a fight buddy. Gerald Merchart, I love to watch Gerald fight GM3. I told Gerald a couple years ago, I said, you know, every time I announce your fight, you win. And so we kind of had a little thing going about that. And then his last fight was, I want to say it was last month, and I was doing it, and he's getting his butt kicked. And he comes out of nowhere, and he wins the fight. And we're in the octagon afterwards, and he reminded me, he goes, hey, I saw you were announcing. And I thought, hey, I'm undefeated when Joe announces me, so I better turn things around here. And, you know, he did, so that was pretty awesome. But, yeah, it's neat. It's neat to build those relationships. And I couldn't tell you that there's one in particular that I'm just like, oh, my gosh, I can't wait to watch this fight. It's just our cards are so stacked most of the time that I get to do that. It's like every one of them's a banger. But yeah, there's a few guys out there that you get a little bit more amped for, and you also feel a little bit of a hurt when they don't get the result that they were hoping for, because I mean, every one of them puts in a lot of effort. They put in all the work in the gym, and the result doesn't always pan out for them. So I wish the best for all of them. Not that I pick one guy over the other or lady over the other, because I appreciate the artistry and all the hard work that goes into it everywhere.
That rings true for one fighter, because if you watched, I know you did, Jose Aldo versus Mario Bautista, I know that you did the announcing for the WEC when Aldo was 22. And now, 16 years later, Aldo's still fighting in the UFC, and I just can't believe that's such a crazy career on that athlete. What did you get from that, seeing that you've seen Aldo's career from 22 all the way to 38 now, and he's been fighting through at the top level, and he hasn't gone down a level this for the last 16 years?
Yeah, how do you even explain that? You know, so there are a lot of anomalies out there. Few anomalies, I would say, in the fight game. Guys that are that resilient. Tom Brady, a quarterback, you know, here in America, you know, with the Patriots forever, and then the Buccaneers, and winning a Super Bowl at his age and continuing to perform at such a high level is so rare and admirable. But yeah, I remember seeing Aldo in those early days and just thinking, oh my gosh. I mean, we were in, I want to say we did a show in Florida, and Mike Brown beat Faber for the belt, but Aldo performed on that card the same night. And I remember talking to Faber afterwards saying, this guy's next, and he's going to be around for a long time. Not that I'm a genius scout, because I'm not the one that found Aldo, but you recognize talent, you know, and he never got full of himself, which is another thing, and that's probably why he's been able to maintain such a high level, because he stayed who he is, you know, true to himself and to the art. He didn't get wrapped up in money and fame. He's a fighter. That's what he does. And he never mailed it in. He showed up to every one of them.
Joe, how did you stay true to yourself?
I think for me, it's foundational, and I'm grounded in my faith. I'm grounded in my marriage and being a father, and those, you know, faith first, because that's really what's carried me through the hard times in my life. You know, there was a lot of self-inflicted things that I went through, you know, in my marriage in the early days, and then having kids and saying, well, you know what? I can't repeat the model that I grew up with. I can't be the absent father in my kid's life. I have to be the one that's there. I have to be the one they look to when it's, you know, and not necessarily a cut on the knee, but maybe it's just a talk. Maybe it's my son coming to me and having an issue with something that only I can help him with, that mom can't, you know, to help walk him through something like that, or just throwing the ball around. You know, I didn't have a dad to throw the ball around with. I had a dad who was abusive. I had a dad that I hid from because I didn't know what his attitude was going to be. You know, if he was going to hit me or he was going to hit my mom, or, you know, my mom had a plan. She says, if he comes home and he starts beating me, get on the phone and, you know, and call, you know, call your aunt. And I remember one night he was beating on my mom and I ran to the phone and I grabbed it. We had a wall phone and I grabbed the phone and I started to dial and he runs out and yanks the phone off the wall and just looked at me with these just dark eyes of anger and hate. And just terrified me to the point that, you know, I didn't want to be around him anymore, you know. And thankfully, you know, my mom left him around the time I'm 8 years old and my younger brother was 3. And I look back at it and, you know, I thank my mom. I thank her all the time. Every Mother's Day and birthday and Christmas, you know, the things I put in those cards that are sent to her are, you saved my life. You know, you saved my life. You saved my brother's life. Because if she didn't leave, I believe he would have killed us. And, you know, I quit that relationship with him around the same time she did. And as I progressed in my career, and this was, you know, things I had to go through. And I remember hearing people from my hometown saying, oh, your father, your dad is so proud of you just about what you do and who you've become. And I said, I don't have a father. I don't have that. That's not my dad. You know, that's the guy that planted the seed, and that's about it. He didn't see it grow. He didn't water it. He didn't participate in anything as far as me growing up and becoming a man. That was my stepdad. That was my grandpa. You know, those two men showed me love. He only ever showed me hate. And, you know, I wrote him a letter. I remember I'm probably about 30 years old at this time. And that's, you know, I basically just told him everything that I told you right now. And then that's where I left it. He died a couple years ago and we were able to kind of fill a gap up a little bit. I think he became a changed man. He accepted Christ and I know he felt a lot of guilt and shame for what he did, as a young parent. And he was 28 years old when I was born, or not 28, he was 20 when I was born, but still young, still a boy. He was also abused growing up, but that was something that I said, okay, I cannot become this man. You know, I learned how to hate first in life, and thankfully I learned how to love, and the love that I received led me into an unconditional love with Christ. And that's what I want to show my kids. That's what I want to be for my family. You know, I want to be that rock. I want to be the foundation stone for this family and point everybody towards Christ. You know, that's, I believe, our mission on earth is to make disciples. Like Matthew 28:19 says, go and make disciples of all nations. You know, it doesn't say, hey, man, you're saved. See you in heaven. It's you know, I don't want to get up there and God says, who'd you bring? And I'm all alone. I want everybody to know. And I feel like if I don't share the gospel truth with anybody, then I'm holding on to the greatest secret that can change their life forever. You know? And not a lot of people want to believe it. Not a lot of people want to receive it. You know? And a lot of people say, you know, oh, well, that's great for you, but it's just not for me. I say, well, you know what, though? Even though it may not be for you, he is for you. You know, he's still for you, no matter what you're going through in life. Like, God loves you. He sent his son to die for you. You know, his son, his own son. You know, and this isn't all fiction. You know, there's more evidence for Christ supporting his existence and in prophecies and miracles and, you know, the things that he did on earth. There's more evidence for that existence, you know, than anything else. Science cannot disprove this. And they try.
Joe, did you pray for your father?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, I did that in 2013. He still didn't have, we didn't have a relationship. I got saved in 2012, and I was dealing with that. And that was, like I said, like salvation. When you receive Christ, I mean, it's like there's nothing greater. You feel amazing. You feel whole. And I did anyway. I get baptized and start walking the walk, and you're just like, man, hey, you come on board, you know, and this is this feeling. But then the sanctification, now you got to start dealing with you. You got to start dealing with the weed in your life, or the things in your heart, the seeds that are that have been planted, that have grown and become things that are hindering your growth. And that was one that God pointed out at me. And I was actually doing a Bible study at a recovery center for drug addicts, and I'm sitting there, and I did a lesson on forgiveness, and I'm teaching them how to forgive. And I get out of there, and I'm like, that was awesome. You know, I'm feeling good, get in my car. And I just felt like God was saying, how could you, when you haven't even done the same thing, how can you go and teach that and preach that when you still have that unforgiveness in your heart? And I let it slide for about 2 months, and then it hit me again. And I'm talking to one of my buddies. We had weekly chats. And I said, you know, I said, Pete, I think God keeps telling me to forgive my father. And he says, well, you better call him and forgive him. And he hung up on me. And I was like, okay, well, there it is. And I called him, and I just told him, I said, look, I don't have questions for you. I don't need any answers or explanation. I just want you to know that I forgive you. And it's not for you. It's for me. You know, he turned it back on himself. Like, you don't know what it was like to be replaced and not be in your life anymore. And I said, let's just stop. You know, that's an untruth that I don't need to hear. And I said, you you weren't replaced. You replaced yourself. You removed yourself. And it just doesn't work on me. You're not going to manipulate your way back into my life or me to feel sorry for you. I forgive you. We move forward. And that's where we left it, you know, until, I mean, probably the month before he died, we were talking every now and then. And that's when I think he came full circle in life and told me, you know, that he had felt guilt and shame for the way he was. And, you know, and I said, well, I've already forgiven you for this. And he goes, but I just feel like I missed out on everything. And I said, well, you did here. I said, but you know what? You're a changed man. You're a saved man. And when you pass, I know where you're going. And I said, whatever we missed out here on earth, we've got eternity. You know, so this isn't the end. You know, it's just for now. So that was a neat moment, I think, for us to be able to share. And it gave him peace. It also has given me peace in his passing. And, you know, I'm good. I'm in a good place.
Joe, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that you were a Christian minister at one point, co-founder of the Anchor of Hope Ministries, and you also were a congregate of the Rock Church, Anaheim. So with all that information and all that, all the work that you've done there, what do you think you would tell your younger self now?
Probably what I was told by wiser men when I was young. You know, there's another way to do this. There's an easier way to live this life. And I think I always tried to replace what I was missing, I would say father-wise, with things, with people that wanted me, with different relationships, because I was never happy. I never found happiness. And that's the thing with happiness, is happiness is temporary. But when you find joy in the struggle, when you find joy in the pain, that's when you truly find God. And it's hard to even tell anybody. I wouldn't say it's hard to tell them. It's hard for anybody to listen when they're going through it. Like, you've seen buddies that have bad relationships, and you just, like, you know where it's headed. And you're trying to convince them to get out, And they don't. And you see them go deeper and deeper into a struggle until they finally get free and they say, gosh, I should have listened. How many times have you heard that? I should have listened to you. Well, I was that. I should have listened so many times. My mom told me, get out of that relationship. No, no, no. even though knowing where it was going, I stayed in it. And why? Why? We've got to cut the cord sometimes. And, you know, one of the things in the Bible, like Jesus says, you've got to prune that bush for new growth. Like, you don't just let a rose bush grow out of control because the flowers are pretty. What happens every winter? You prune it down to nothing so it can have new growth. And that's what we have to do in our own lives. It's like, we've got to start pruning those things in our life that are sucking us dry. Remove them from our life so we can have new growth. And it could be anything. It could be a car. It could be a house. It could be friends that you're trying to help. Sometimes you just got to let them fall. You got to let them find their own bottom, and then they'll start to grow. But if you're holding on to them, you can't even grow. You're hindering your own growth. So I think that's what I'd tell myself. It's set yourself free. Be free of these things, and then see what God can do. Trust the process, right?
The final question I have for you, Joe, is you said that you're always somewhere where you're supposed to be. So why don't people feel like they're where they want to be?
Listen, when you're following the world, you can find yourself in places where you think you're supposed to be and put yourself in a situation that you don't want to be in. You can get compromised. So I've eliminated as effectively as I can possibly those opportunities for me, because I know what I'm capable of. I know the destruction I'm capable of. So me eliminating those opportunities, rather, let's say after a show, instead of going to the bar, go to my room or go to eat with somebody I trust. Now I'm setting myself up for success. But if I'm going freelance and I say, I'm going to go test myself at this bar and maybe have a drink, now I'm opening up a door that's already been sealed shut. So why would I go back to, let's say biblically, like even dogs eat their own vomit. Why would I go back to my own vomit when I already have a steak dinner? You know, why would I go back to milk and cookies when I have a full five-star meal? I don't need that stuff. It doesn't enhance my growth. Is having a beer going to bring me closer to God? Is running around with some woman that's not my wife going to enhance my relationship with Christ? No, it's going to destroy me. It's going to destroy my family. So why would I do that?
That's all we have time for, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Joe. Is there any final remarks you want to say to the fans at home as we wrap up the podcast today?
I'd say you're all loved. And once you start believing that truth, that God has a plan and a purpose for your life and every struggle you go through, if you put your faith in Him, I promise you, give Him a year. Heck, give Him a month and see what He can do.
Follow Joe Martinez on Instagram or social media. We've got the links in the description, and follow Anything Combat. We will see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Johnny.
Chomping at the bit, Johnny. Let's go.